This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Claire Danes, the star of the Showtime series Homeland, which is in its eighth and final season. She plays a CIA officer who's brilliant, but sometimes behaves erratically because she has bipolar disorder. It's sometimes difficult for her fellow officers to tell if she's on the verge of a breakthrough or if she's being paranoid during a manic episode. Danes was a teenager when she became known for her starring role on the series My So-Called Life, about a girl in high school dealing with anxieties about sexuality, school, and parents. The show was canceled in 1995 after one season, but it's had a long afterlife. Danes has revealed a remarkable emotional range in the role of Carrie Matheson in Homeland and has won 2 Emmys and 2 Golden Globes. The focus of the series was initially on fighting terrorism, but more recently, Homeland dealt with Russian meddling in American politics and a conspiracy within the American government to take down the president. At the end of last season, Carrie was captured by Russian intelligence. She was imprisoned, interrogated, and her medication was withheld, which left her in a psychotic state when she was released. In the first episode of the new season, the new president wants to end the war in Afghanistan, and Carrie's old boss at the CIA, who's now the national security advisor, wants to send her there because she has so many contacts in Kabul. But some officers in the CIA are worried that she might have been compromised while held by the Russians. In this scene, she's being questioned by a CIA officer.
You were detained in Russia for 213 days?
Yes.
And you were interrogated for the first...
30-ish.
Who was your interrogator?
A colonel named Sergei Tabakov. Most of the time, anyway. GRU.
Why'd he stop?
All of this is in the file.
It's a big file. Can you tell me why he stopped interrogating you?
I think because I threw my feces at him.
And was that strategic?
No, I was in the midst of a florid psychosis. They withheld my medication and took about 20 days for me to devolve into a not very helpful subject. But they kept at it for another week or so. I can't give you an exact figure. After that, it's all either blank or a series of images that don't much comport with reality. If we're doing this a slow way, maybe I will take some water.
Doug informs me you'd like to be reinstated at the agency.
Yes. Yes, I would like that very much.
A security clearance isn't an option with upwards of 180 days unaccounted for.
Yeah, I know that. That's why I've been working so hard with Dr. Foley and Doug, trying to fill in the gaps. Did they give you the impression that wasn't the case?
No. Did they tell you you failed your polygraph? Deception indicated. So you're going to have to bear with me.
Which questions?
You said it was usually Tabakov, but not always.
I'd like to know which questions, please.
Quite a few, actually.
Such as?
Have you ever conspired with a foreign intelligence officer or service?
So what does that mean? Are you accusing me of something?
Could mean a lot of things. Giving up sources and methods, working for the enemy. You tell me.
Claire Danes, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much.
So Homeland has often been really timely, and in this season, the new president is trying, through Saul Berenson, the new national security advisor who had been your boss at the CIA, he's trying to negotiate peace with the Taliban. And right now, the Trump administration is trying to negotiate peace with the Taliban. Of the events in Homeland that have been echoed in real life, what's the one that really kind of took you up short the most? And I'm talking about something that happened in Homeland before it happened in real life.
Right. Well, I mean, seasons back, suddenly it became clear that Russia was a fairly nefarious presence, right? I wasn't aware of that when we began the season. I mean, originally, we were telling a story that spoke directly to the aftermath of 9/11. We were focusing on terrorism as we knew it 10 years ago. And so much has transpired since then, right? And yeah, suddenly Trump was elected, you know, and then the whole idea of the CIA was in like serious question in a way that we couldn't have anticipated, I don't think. But we are pretty assiduous in getting as close a reading of what's happening in the current political climate as possible. Every year before the writers start designing the season, we spend a week in D.C. talking to people in the clandestine services and journalists and political insiders. And, you know, we kind of take a deep dive into what's churning and what's going to be especially relevant in a year's time when the show is going to air. But even so, there's always some kind of inexplicable force at play that creates some mirroring that there's no way we could have even anticipated.
At the end of the previous season, season 7, when you were imprisoned by the Russians, they withheld your medications for bipolar disorder. And so when you're released, you're in full psychosis, and your eyes are just wild and unfocused, and they're not registering what you see. You see Saul Berenson, you know, who you're very close to. He had been your boss at the CIA. He's played by Mandy Patinkin. And it looks like you're running toward him because he's there to receive you. But actually, you run right past him because nothing is registering on you. You're just in a state of wild fear. What impact did it have on you mentally to inhabit someone with a mental health disorder who is forced off of her meds?
Well, it felt like a privilege, honestly. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I love doing what we do as actors, is that we get to go to the outer reaches of our imagination and empathize with people who might seem very remote or other or inaccessible, and suddenly you get to feel not only intimate with them, but sort of merged with them. You get to embody them. And it's really fascinating, you know, to attempt to look at the world through such a different lens. So, yeah, and I actually, you know what, honestly, it's so interesting just talking to you now, imagining it. My body is starting to change, like my heart rate is starting to quicken, and I feel a little bit more adrenalized, and it's so interesting. It's like you have a contact high just through your imagination. Even just recalling it now, it's starting to happen to my system involuntarily. And I don't quite understand how that works, but it does.
I feel like your voice changed as you were saying that.
Yeah, it's true.
What else changed?
It's really my heart. My heart started like really racing. And the sound guys on the show would pick it up through the mic, you know.
Pick up your heartbeat?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. You have a mic on your chest by your heart. But, you know, it's just so wild, this acting thing. Still kind of a mystery.
So John Lahr in The New Yorker wrote a great profile of you a while ago. And he wrote that there were a couple of times in your childhood that you described as dalliances with madness, where you had terrifying visions of ghosts and gargoyles emerging from the shower head and from shapes in the woodwork, and that brought you to a psychiatrist. Do you have an understanding of what happened?
I don't really. I mean, I think I probably had a very active imagination and was learning how to wrangle it, to differentiate the real from the unreal. And that takes discipline. And I think I was still just developing it. I also think maybe there was kind of burgeoning OCD, because a lot of the behavior was ritualistic. And, you know, these creatures that I saw in quotes would talk to me and tell me to do things like, you know, I remember one time I was supposed to hold a contorted position for 20 minutes or something. But I think there were some overlaps there. And it didn't take long to undo it. As soon as I found myself in a therapist's office at 6, I was like, oh, I think I have a problem. And as soon as I became conscious of it, it almost immediately started to dissipate.
So when you were young and you had those visions, those images in your head, were you afraid to go to sleep? Afraid of what would happen when you dream?
Oh, gosh, I was terrified of the dark, which lasted for a long time. Like, even in college, I remember if I had to pee in the night, you know, in my dorm, I would call my boyfriend and wake him up so he could escort me to the bathroom. I mean, how ridiculous. I have to say, I'm at 40, I've matured past that. But no, there were vestiges of that, you know. Yeah, it lasted for quite a while.
You seem to know that you wanted to be an actor when you were really young.
Really young. It was so weird. I was so clear about it. And I can't tell you why. I mean, I grew up in a very creative environment. My parents had been visual artists, and I lived in downtown New York in the 80s, you know. So that may have had something to do with it. But nobody in my immediate circle were performing artists. When I was five, I saw Madonna bopping around on television, and I just had this epiphany that was a choice, that could be like your vocation. And I just thought, well, yes. I literally started jumping up and down on the bed because I was so excited by the idea. And then a little while later, I realized that acting specifically was a strain of the performing arts, and that was the one that I was most interested in. But somebody told me around the age of 9 that most actors don't make much money, which I found concerning. So I amended my plan. I was going to be a therapist and do acting workshops on the side. And that was my plan for a good year. And I don't know how seriously my parents took me, you know, but I started taking acting classes, and I went to a performing arts junior high school, and I met other kids who were doing it professionally. And, you know, and I figured out how to get an agent, and it was so self-driven.
Wait, you figured out how to get an agent? Not your parents?
Yeah.
How did you figure it out?
Talking to my friends at school who had, you know, were doing this for real. And my dad had been a photographer, so we had a dark room in our loft, and the woman who was renting it out took my headshots, and we sent them out. I mean, it was very makeshift. I just used whatever resources we had.
So how old were you when you had your first headshots?
I was 12.
What were they like?
We took them on the streets of New York, and I kind of have a feeling that we may have taken them on the block that I now live on in the West Village, because people take headshots there on that block a lot. I think it's like headshot block. I could be making that up, but that's, you know, yeah.
So, you know, you said that one of the downsides of acting when you were young was that you knew actors, on the whole, weren't going to make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Did your parents not have a lot of money, and was that, like, an issue you grew up with?
Well, they had been artists, and then they did take on more conventional jobs eventually, maybe for financial reasons, so I may have intuited that a little bit. My dad became a contractor, and my mom ran a toddler school in our loft. And again, I mean, I was living in a world that was populated by artists, and I think I saw what that struggle could be.
So how old were you when your mother opened the toddler school in your loft?
I was 4.
Were you home when school was in session, or did they send you to another place?
No. They would arrive as I was kind of getting ready to go to school, and they'd be there for maybe an hour or two when I got back home from school. So I know a lot of nursery rhymes, a lot. It served me well in the raising of my boys. There were like raisins everywhere. There was diluted apple juice. in the fridge always.
What was it like to have your home also be a school for toddlers?
It wasn't exactly easy. It didn't strictly feel like my home. I knew I had to share it, and I knew I had to share my mom, which wasn't always the best feeling, but she was really good at it. She was really celebrated in our little world of Soho. She was like the mother goose of downtown New York.
Did any of the kids in your mother's daycare center grow up to be people who you became friends with?
Well, actually, I am friends with Lena Dunham, and one of the first things she ever told me when we met years ago was that she was she was rejected from my mom's school.
Oh, she was rejected from it?
She was a reject, yeah. It was not personal, I'm sure. I do run into kids now who were in the baby school. And it's bizarre because I do vividly remember them when they were bald and pre-verbal.
Your first television role, I think, was on an episode of Law and Order.
Mm-hmm.
What season?
Dun, dun.
Yeah. Yeah. Which season was it? Who were the detectives in?
Oh, gosh. It was, must have been like 91. Oh, I was so excited. I was so excited. I played a teenage murderer.
Oh, you were the murderer?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. I played the daughter of a prostitute. I didn't know that she had been a prostitute. I thought that she was a model, and her pimp slash agent or something was grooming me to be a model. And then when my mom found out, she forced him to quit working with me, and I went into a rage, and I murdered him with scissors. Maybe he was a photographer. Maybe that's what... anyway, yeah. You don't actually see it happen, but you hear about it on the stand.
What was it like to see yourself on TV the first time?
Oh, I remember the day after it aired, going on the subway and being sure that I would have a hard time on the commute because so many people would recognize me. I think we had a viewing party at home the night before. It was very sweet. I was just thrilled.
You were 13 when you auditioned for My So-Called Life. And that show only lasted one season, but it really had a huge impact. Like, it's been described as cable TV before there was really cable, because mm-hmm. it was just a much more true-to-life and sophisticated series than was on broadcast TV mm-hmm. at the time, for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you were terrific in it.
Thanks.
And a lot of people grew up with that show. I mean, it made a really big impression on them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you said that your character, Angela, was going through some of the same things that you were going through when mm-hmm. you were 13 and auditioned, and then later on when the series actually got made.
Yeah.
Which was,
yeah.
what, about a year later?
Yeah.
So what were some of the things that you were going through that you heard articulated in the series?
Oh, gosh. Your first crush, you know, your face breaking out, that feeling of isolation. I still remember there was one line in the pilot where it said, "I can't bring myself to eat in front of my mother. It just means too much to her." which I, of course, think about all the time now as I tell my kids to eat their spinach. But it was so paralleled. And sometimes there would be an episode that I didn't fully understand because I actually hadn't arrived at that experience myself. And then a week later, I would, you know. So it was this really amazing dance.
So in terms of things that you went through, that your character went through, I want to play a scene from My So-Called Life. And you and Jordan Catalano, who you had a big crush on in this series, uh-huh. had kissed. But the rumor was going around in school that you actually had sex, which you did not. Your mother's heard the rumor and decides it's time to have the talk with you about mm-hmm. birth control. Mm-hmm. So here is my guest Claire Danes and Bess Armstrong as her mother in a scene from My So-Called Life. And in the scene, she's in her bedroom listening to the Cranberries, and you'll hear that. And I should mention, we're also going to hear Claire Danes doing a voiceover in this scene.
We need to talk.
When I was 12, my mother gave me my sex talk. I'm not sure either of us has fully recovered.
Now that you and Jordan are...
Oh, my God. Mom, please.
Angela. I can accept that you have a boyfriend.
I don't have a boyfriend.
Fine. A pal. A male pal. Whatever word you want to choose. The point is, I'm your mother, and I don't think you're ready.
Mom, please.
I don't think you're ready. But I have to know if this is what's happening, because I don't think that I can keep
Mom,
you
Mom, I beg you to stop.
I need to know that you're using... I mean, I remember how this feels, I do, but it's the times that we live in.
Mom, please.
Honey, I know you don't want to think about these things. I know that you think you're invulnerable,
but... I don't think that.
You have
no idea.
To use some kind of protection if you are going to be...
Mom, I'm not having sex, all right? Really. I'm not even close to an embarrassing degree.
Oh.
Okay.
I'm sorry, honey. I want you to be prepared when the time comes. Whenever the time comes.
It'll never come. Not with Jordan.
Is that what's bothering
you? No, nothing's bothering me.
Something's bothering you.
Mom, you couldn't possibly understand or help, so please. I don't mean to hurt your feelings, okay. But just please.
That's my guest, Claire Danes, with Bess Armstrong in a scene from My So-Called Life. Did you have that talk with your mother?
I don't remember having that talk, but I remember when I got my period and, like, my mom kind of discovered it because she was doing the laundry and approaching me about that and just feeling, like, devastated, which was funny because I trusted her and it was so relaxed between us and... But there are just some things that feel shameful by definition almost, you know, which is so sad. It's so sad. But it's scary stuff, right? And I don't know. But yeah, isn't that... Oh, it's such a beautifully written scene.
It is.
So recognizable.
It is. How old were you when you got your period?
I was young. I was 11. And I was terrified.
What do you think you were afraid of? Were you afraid of... maturing or afraid of the blood?
Yeah, of like looming womanhood mm-hmm. and sex and all of these big ideas that I was ill prepared for, that I couldn't begin to make any sense of. So, yeah, and I flinched. You know? Yeah.
Were you afraid of your friends finding out?
I was afraid of all of it. I was just afraid of it. I was afraid of the change. And I had reason to be, because you're living in, like, a Kafka story. no, it's just the worst. I mean, when I was pregnant, I kind of felt that way again, just that, you know, you have to cede total control. Your body just riots, and it never consults you about any of these things.
So you have two children, and they're both pretty young. And one of them was born, I think, in 2018, and the other earlier in the series. Was it hard when you were pregnant, or when you were like a new mother, to go back and forth between, you know, being in a pregnant state or being a new mother?
It was really hard.
Yeah, and getting into all the difficult situations that Carrie is in when her life is always at stake.
Yeah, at one point, I was pregnant with Cyrus. We were shooting the second season. I was about 7 months pregnant. It was a night shoot. We were shooting in some old sewage factory, some kind of icky place. And I had been kidnapped by... the baddie of the season, Abu Nazir, and I was handcuffed to a pipe. It was 4 a.m. I was so tired, and I just thought, like, I don't think this is safe. You know, this is just exactly the opposite of where I want to be deep into my third trimester. It was pretty crazy.
So you've shot the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like to come to the end?
I still feel like I'm coming to it, you know. It's been 10 years of my life. It's been 8 seasons, but it's been 10 years, and it's been a formative 10 years, you know. I started the show as a barely married person, and I'm leaving the show as a mother of two. The last really meaningful scene I had was with Mandy. It was, of course, a very dramatic one. And I definitely fell apart emotionally, and I just remember... Well, I'm getting emotional talking about it now, but just remember sort of clinging to him. You know, it's very profound what you share, the trust that you build over that length of time. And we shot the show all over the planet. I mean, really, we went in Israel and Morocco and South Africa and Berlin. It was kind of epic.
Well, I really look forward to seeing how the series ends.
Me too.
Yeah.
I haven't seen all the episodes, so.
Do you watch?
I'm excited to share it. I will. I tend to watch it with everybody else. I don't even know why exactly. I have the means of getting a hold of the episodes.
I would imagine you do.
I kind of like tuning in with everybody else.
Claire Danes, this has been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's such a treat and an honor to talk to you. I just love you.
Claire Danes stars in the Showtime series Homeland, which is in its 8th and final season. The film Portrait of a Lady on Fire won the screenwriting prize at Cannes last year, and it's begun opening in American theaters. It's the latest film from the acclaimed French filmmaker Céline Sciamma. It tells the story of the relationship between a young woman painter and the young woman who is her reluctant model. Critic at large John Power says the film is a brainy, beautiful story of a search for freedom.
The BBC recently released a list of the 100 best films by female filmmakers, as chosen by a poll of film experts from over 80 countries. If the number one movie came as no big surprise, it was Jane Campion's 1993 The Piano, it was hard not to be struck that the vast majority of the list had been made since then. This isn't because the experts have the attention span of gnats, but because for most of film history, it was hard, bordering on impossible, for women to make movies. That's finally begun to change in recent decades, and we're now enjoying an explosion of women filmmakers telling new stories, or reworking old ones from a new angle. Although she's just over 40, the French writer-director Céline Sciamma already has 3 films on the BBC list. The highest-ranked and best of them is her latest, the smart, beautifully acted Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Sciamma's earlier work was about adolescents dealing with gender identity, dawning sexual awareness, and female solidarity. She raises these themes to an even higher cinematic level in this latest movie, a gorgeous costume drama that takes a classic male theme, the artist and his muse, and revises it in a revelatory feminist direction. The time is the late 18th century, the dawn of the Romantic era, when a young painter named Marianne, played by Noémie Merlant, gets called to a remote, wave-battered island off Brittany. She's been commissioned to paint the portrait of Héloïse, played by Adèle Haenel, who's been pulled from a convent in order to marry the Milanese fiancé of her dead sister. There's just one problem. Héloïse refuses to pose. Marianne must paint her on the sly, while pretending to have been hired as her personal companion. As the two stroll the beaches and cliffs, Marianne tries to memorize the features of the fast-walking Héloïse, a proud, angry woman who resents being shipped off to an Italian man she knows nothing about. Such big-souled yearning for independence is something Marianne can identify with. Her own artistic career is being held back by being a woman. Their connection grows ever deeper, as the worldly Marianne introduces her muse to pleasures like harpsichord music. And Héloïse wants the painter to grasp the difference between a portrait that captures what someone looks like and one that captures who they are. Bit by bit, the two grow more and more charged with the desire that we wait to burst into flame. And it does. Portrait of a Lady on Fire is erotic, but not in the male, gazy way of movies like Blue is the Warmest Color, where the sex scenes seem to exist more for the audience than for the characters. Although there is a touch of nudity, Sciamma's female gaze is subtle, restrained, from the lingering way Marianne studies the flesh tone surrounding Héloïse's ear, to the dazzling moment, I won't spoil it, when Marianne does a self-portrait in a book she's lent Héloïse. Not so long ago, it was brave, even transgressive, merely to tell a lesbian love story on screen. That's less true today, at least in the West, as Sciamma well knows. Even as she builds her story toward a deeply moving conclusion, she takes care to give us much more, from Claire Maton's exquisite cinematography to a startling look at abortion, 18th century style. Men scarcely appear in the film, yet it's part of Sciamma's point that they don't need to be present to shape the heroine's futures. Patriarchy is the element in which women, even heroic ones, must swim. Which isn't to say that her vision is defeatist. Quite the contrary. Portrait of a Lady on Fire is about seeing. Seeing the world, seeing other people, seeing a different way of living, and then acting on it. On their small island, Marianne and Héloïse catch a glimpse of utopia. They create, however briefly, a small realm of freedom that predicts a time, 200 years later, when a woman like Sciamma can freely make a film that celebrates their forbidden love.
John Powers is our critic at large. He reviewed the film Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Now we have something special from our producer, Sam Brigger, a conversation with and performance by the duo Rachel and Villery. I'm glad he introduced me to their music, and I think you'll enjoy it too. If you listen to their self-titled debut album, which came out late last year, you might think that they were singing lost jazz and swing tunes from the 30s and 40s, but the songs are actually new ones composed by Villery. The two met when they were at the New England Conservatory of Music, but only recently started performing together. Rachel Price is also the lead singer of the soul-inspired rock band Lake Street Dive. Rachel and Villery's music is a departure from that band, but both Rachel and Villery have loved the music of the 30s and 40s for a long time. Rachel and Villery spoke with our producer Sam Brigger and performed some songs. So here's Sam Brigger with Rachel and Villery.
Rachel and Villery, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You guys are very generous. You were willing to perform a little bit for us today. So I was wondering if you could please start with Do Friends Fall in Love?
Sure can.
Yeah.
Count them, but tonight was something new, and I know you felt it too when we fell into the passion of a kiss around the world. We've shared these roads together. Every journey is grand when you're holding my hand. Do friends fall in love like this? A look that once was merely warm now blazes with an ardent desire. A touch that once was just a touch burns hotter than a five-alarm fire. Oh, say, oh, mine, for all our days to follow. What was innocent before has become a grand amour. Two friends fell in love like this. Was merely warm, now blazes with an ardent desire. A touch that once was just a touch burns hotter than a five-alarm fire. Oh, say, oh, mine, for all our days to follow. As friends we lived before,
and we'll live evermore.
Together, two friends in love.
Oh, that was great. Thank you so much for doing that. That was Do Friends Fall in Love by Rachel and Villery from their debut album, which is also called Rachel and Villery. What was the inspiration for that song?
You know, it was actually a commissioned song.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a woman wanted to give a song as a present to her husband-to-be, and also she wanted it to work as something for them to walk down the aisle to. So, yeah, that was actually the second draft. She hated the first version.
What did she like about the first version?
The first version acknowledged that unhappiness exists.
People don't want that at a wedding.
They don't want that at a wedding. You know, but that's kind of what I like in a song. I like to acknowledge that unhappiness exists in basically every song that I write.
Do you remember some of the lyrics from the first version, the sort of more
version? Or? It wasn't morose. I mean, it was really just like a single line. All the sorrow and strife brought me here. Now they're melting away. The concept of the song was every step that you've taken as a human being through life, happy and sad, brought you to the moment that you met the person and fell in love with them. So I thought that was a strong concept.
Yeah, I think so too. Your voices blend so well. Was that something that happened right away, or did you have to work on that?
I think it was pretty immediate. Our voices blend because we understand the style of music, and I think we understand the accent really well, mm-hmm. which is a big part of it. So that sort of fit together immediately, but just two voices harmonizing well together was really tricky. I'd say probably we played a lot of gigs where we sounded pretty out of tune when we first started.
And also, Rachel's an incredibly strong singer, and even if you like my singing, you wouldn't call it strong. Mm-hmm. I think that's what we've maybe talked the least about but learned the most in the process of singing with each other.
So did you have to tell Rachel to sing quieter? Did you have to step it up?
Or,
yeah, I don't know. I think we've just sort of like, we share a single microphone on stage, an old 30s RCA ribbon microphone. So you can do a lot with dynamics. She can continue to be very powerful, but just ease off a little bit and I can ease on.
And Rachel, you said you know the accents of this music. Could you elaborate on that?
I mean, they didn't talk the same and they sure didn't sing the same throughout. You know, it changes from decade to decade. And my guess is a lot of that has to do with how they were self-monitoring and the type of microphone they were using. Mm-hmm. But it embodies the sound of the music, the type of accent. I don't really know. It's like you'd have to talk to somebody who's like a musicologist. Maybe it had to do with like Mid-Atlantic or I don't really know. But it's pretty different. And I think it would sound strange if you didn't sort of emulate the accent somewhat when you were singing this style of music.
I think the person who epitomizes the accent best is Johnny Mercer. I think Johnny Mercer like really understands how to like write swinging lyrics and then deliver them in a swinging way. And certainly when I'm writing, I'm thinking a lot about Johnny Mercer. I think something like The Laundromat Swing, which is something that we do, that I wrote. I was thinking of Johnny Mercer a lot
when
I was writing that song. Yeah.
Would you guys mind just doing a little tiny bit of that song?
Sure.
Drop your lucky nickel down the money slot, then toss your dirty drawers where it's piping hot. If you want to take your baby to the dancing spot, you've got to do the laundromat swing. Every working fella on a Friday night, by 20 after 5 days getting right. If you're going to show the lady she's your true delight, you've got to do the laundromat swing.
Yeah, that's a great song. And at the end, you sort of do that double time, too, which must be pretty hard to do.
Yeah, I don't know if we would double time that tempo. But
yeah.
Depends on where we start.
Yeah, fair enough. You guys are so close to each other. As I said, you're performing like, you know, just on the other side of a microphone. Are you guys ever worried you're like getting your coffee breath all over your partner? Or?
Oh, we have talked about hygiene. Dental hygiene has been, a big discussion.
We used to actually brush our teeth before every show.
Together.
I don't know why we don't anymore.
I don't think we stand as close.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, I think there was a time when breath was a real concern.
We
had
a much
smaller
microphone
to chew some gum. Yeah.
Before.
So a larger microphone blocks it a little bit now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, big microphones make good neighbors.
Well, a different scenario for you, Villery, was, I don't know if you still do it, but you did some busking in the New York City subway stations.
You know what? I stopped, and I'll tell you why, because they brought cell service in, and there was a magical thing that was happening wherein you couldn't be reached, and it was the only place you couldn't be reached when they didn't have cell service. And it happened many times that people would come up to me having waited 15 minutes for a train and heard three songs, and they would come up to me with like tears in their eyes, having just been broken up with, or in the midst of falling in love with somebody, and just been like, I cannot believe what a touching experience I just had musically. And that was like such a high, obviously, for me.
Yeah.
And once they brought cell phones in, that really went away.
Really?
And so did I.
Was that a way to sort of just get your chops up to speed after not playing for a long time?
Absolutely, yeah. The reverberation in there really make you want to like reach and sing strongly. And it was a great, great way to learn.
Did you have a favorite stop or station?
Yeah, the Metropolitan stop on the G train.
Why was that?
That's kind of where everyone goes. It's a good hub, so it's where the G train and the L train meet. So you get a lot of traffic of people coming from Manhattan who've traveled cross town on the L and are getting on the G. And also the G is very slow, so people
so you get
standing
a lingering audience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
people require two or three songs before they're like, okay, I can't not give this person money. If you've had an emotional experience with three songs, if you've had one with one, you're like, oh God, I'm really feeling things today, you know? But if you've had one with three, you're like, that guy is making me feel things.
And then would people not get on their train and just hang out and listen to you?
Yeah, that definitely happened. And I would get gigs, you know, wedding gigs and stuff like that. And people would film me. And yeah, it was a very special, and I played a lot with my friend Damon Hankoff, who I went to high school with. He played bass with me a lot. And mm-hmm. You know, it was just like a great way to learn each other in terms of our playing and learn tunes and make arrangements up, and it was really cool.
You have a song called Alone at Last, which is about someone who has some, I guess, social anxiety, but then when they finally find someone who they're in love with, then they finally feel that they're alone at last. And it sounds, Rachel revealed in an interview that that's a little bit about yourself.
Yes, that's a song that I wrote for my fiance, and you know, I don't generally, I didn't write it for her, but I wrote it about my feelings for her. And yeah, I'm uncomfortable around people. And as a New Yorker, I think many New Yorkers are sort of neurotic people who are uncomfortable around people. And I think it can come off as not quite, I don't know, grumpiness maybe. Mm-hmm. So I'm often grumpy, but my fiance kind of puts me at peace. I've had a lot of feedback from introverted people who say, well, that's how I feel too. So I think I hit on something.
Would you guys mind just doing a few lines of that?
Sure.
Once was agoraphobic, Times Square would make me gasp. I let full trains go past with you. I feel alone at last.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's wonderful. How does your uncomfortableness around crowds affect performing live?
You know what? I love it. I can't quite explain it. And maybe eventually I will come to hate it. But I think there's something about having a stranger say that they've touched you, touched them, that is very fulfilling for me.
When Rachel said that she wanted to sing with you, did you start writing pieces specifically for her?
I think I started off just sort of writing. Rachel was talking about like learning Ella Fitzgerald and learning Sarah Vaughan. And I think I was like very committed to the idea that I should be very pure and write for people of the era. And so I was writing Sinatra songs and Fats Waller songs and Billie Holiday songs and Peggy Lee songs. And I think that's how I did it for a long time. And we certainly sing a lot of those songs. Mm-hmm. But I think Alone at Last is a song for Rachel. And I think we have a song called Without a Thought for My Heart, which I definitely wrote with Peggy Lee in mind, but with also knowing that Rachel doesn't sing like Peggy Lee very often, and that I think she would kill it singing mm-hmm. like Peggy Lee, kind of in a vulnerable, whispering, soft space. And it took us a while to get to that place in the recording studio where she felt comfortable doing it. But it's everything I dreamed of when I was writing that song. And it's not exactly what you would think of as a Rachel Price song, but I think it's like exactly what I think of as an ideal interpretation.
Hmm. Well, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you guys. And I'm going to ask you to do one more song. And Vilrie, this is a song that you just mentioned, which was Without a Thought for My Heart. You said this is a song that you wrote thinking about Peggy Lee?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She has a very tender, very quiet way of singing that is incredibly all hers. And it's my platonic ideal of what romantic female crooning is. So, yeah, I wrote it with that idea.
Well, why don't we hear it? But before we do, I just want to thank you both so much for coming on the show. Rachel, Vilrie, thank you very much for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you for
talking
to us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
that I was too young for anything beyond just your selfish bit of fun. Right from the start, without a thought for my heart, you held me near and simply whispered that we should be so glad for the moments that we had. We knew you'd part without a thought for my heart. Now ain't the time for thinking. I should have done my thinking months ago. I may not know which man's worth keeping, but now I surely know the kind who ought to go. A parting kiss, with this I crumble, and all my fantasies are scattered by the breeze. I played my part without a thought for my heart. It wasn't smart. It wasn't smart. I played my part without a thought for my heart.
Rachel and Villery spoke with our producer, Sam Brigger. Their self-titled debut album was released late last year.
Everybody knows there's only one place I go when I want to hear the news. That's to your mother's house, where we talk about you. She shows me pictures of little you in the nude, and it would be rude of me not to let her see the ones that I had to give you.
Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Challoner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a program that adjusts insurance rates based on safe driving habits. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from Noom, a personalized weight loss program designed to give people knowledge to set new goals and the tools to stick to them for good. Learn more at Noom, N-O-O-M.com.